Hey everybody, I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond.
I'm here with PTSD and Beyond, and we have another fantastic episode. I say this each week where every time we have a guest that comes on, it's our bar of generosity just continues to grow and grow and grow. And this month, as everybody knows, our PTSD and Beyond chats are focused on community and community building. And with our guest this week, I have to tell you guys, this is a person who is making a profound difference around the world. This is an individual who goes by a nickname of the Wounded Healer. And what's wonderful about his story is that he openly shares struggles and challenges in a way that people with lived experiences, right? We resonate with not only in addition to their story, it helps us with ourselves reduce mental health related stigma. And the cool thing too is that we come together in unity as a community to make a difference. Once again, our fantastic guest says, there's a quote here, is that recovery from mental health difficulties are a reality for many and not the few, and seeking help with mental health difficulties is a sign of strength. And you guys, that strength comes from being a wounded healer. When we go through our own healing and we share that with other people, we reduce stigma, we embrace vulnerability, and we do it from the heart. So let me just share a few fantastic accolades of our guest. This person, he is a 2013 Royal College Psychiatrist Foundation Doctor of the Year, and also in 2018 received the Royal College Psychiatrist Core Psychiatric Trainee of the Year Award, which is, guys, the highest level of achievement in psychiatry in the United Kingdom. And again, you know this individual as the Wounded Healer on Twitter. And folks, let's give a heartfelt welcome to Dr. Ahmed Hankir. Ahmed, welcome to PTSD and Beyond.
Wow, what an introduction. Dr. Lindt, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and a privilege, and I'm delighted and I'm excited, and I look forward to sharing and to learning and to embracing. So we're on this journey together.
We are on this journey together, and what's amazing about being on the journey together, and guys, Ahmed and I were talking, of course. I mean, I know you guys know how I am, you know, long-winded, but we had this wonderful conversation about journey and being on the path together and the value of that, right? The value of that. And one of the things that brings the value of being on this journey together is the way that we can bring change. So in change in a revolution that is of unity. And we see it all around the globe today, and the impact that it's making for so many people. We see the tears, we see the smiles, we see the happiness, we see people of all different varieties, right? Not differences, but uniquenesses, embracing one another, extending a hand, sharing water, lifting one another up. It's absolutely amazing. And so let's ask our fantastic guest to share with us today a little bit about, you know, who you are, how you got to where you're at. I mean, I know people can go on your website, but it's always nice to hear from the person directly, just some things about yourself. So what would you like to share with our listeners today about yourself, Ahmed?
Thank you for asking and to reiterate inviting me to contribute. So what would I like to share about myself? And you mentioned, Dr. Lind, embracing our vulnerability. And I think it's so important to do so, because that way we can develop authentic relationships with others. And that can be people who receive mental health care or family members, friends. So I really want to emphasize the importance of authenticity, mm-hmm, in relationships with others. Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? My name is Ahmed Hankir. I identify as both a mental health care receiver and provider. I'm a psychiatrist in London, in the United Kingdom. I'm a mental health advocate. I'm a survivor. Mm-hmm. My mind, I was the victim of psychological torture. And my mind was mutilated when I was younger, when I was a medical student. I recovered. And now I'm a man on a mission. And I want to challenge mental health stigma, dignify and empower people with mental health difficulties. And I want to break down the barriers to mental health care. And as you said, seeking help, is a sign of strength and not a sign of weakness. And let there be no ambiguity about that. And also some of the messages that I try to deliver through the Wounded Healer movement, mm-hmm. if you like, that having mental health difficulties is nothing to be ashamed about. So a bit, but I mean, I really, my passion is harnessing the power of storytelling and the performing arts.
Oh yeah.
To break down the barriers to mental health care, to reduce mental health related stigma. And so I pioneered this program called the Wounded Healer Program, which has been described as an innovative method of teaching that blends the power of the performing arts and storytelling with psychiatry, because the argument we make is, how can you educate an audience if you can't engage them?
Right.
So that's what I do. Yep. I reenact scenes from famous films, Pulp Fiction, Blade Runner, to engage with my audiences. And then once engaged, I educate them with the facts. And The Wounded Healer also traces my recovery journey from impoverished and hopeless service user, if you like, with suicidal thoughts, to empowered psychiatrist, mental health advocate, survivor. And so that's my journey so far, Dr. Lind.
That's incredible. You know what? I have to say one thing is I absolutely love the conviction and the passion that you speak with. And there's so much energy with words. And in previous sessions, we've talked about the power of words, right? The power of spoken words and blending and integrating performing arts with psychiatry and mental health is so key. You know, we could talk about whether it's theater or music. I mean, we have everything from composers to writers to poets to authors of so many different mediums resonate with people, and people will say, why does this song still stick with me, right? There are songs that people can listen to that transforms us, you know, takes us back to another time in a period. There are songs that people will say, you know what, I'm doing recovery and I'm forcing myself to listen to songs and watch movies that were painful in the past and are no longer, say, triggering, or I'm able to watch this and wow, I've gotten a growth component out of it. So to hear that you're blending performing arts along with psychiatry is so refreshing, because they're two mediums that actually blend really nicely together.
And
they blend nicely together because what it does is, and as you mentioned this, it helps create meaningful and important contributions in the world. So we already know that performing arts does that. And we already know that psychiatry does that. And so we can take the best pieces, right? Or new pieces that are innovative and creative and blend the two, then we really have an opportunity to bring beautiful healing and recovery for so many people, including our colleagues, because one of the things that doesn't get discussed, I don't think, very often, is the secondary trauma of being, you know, working in the industry, whether you're a medical doctor, a nurse, a first responder, a social worker, a coach that works with mental health. There's different types of traumas that people experience. And right now, so many of us experience those. So, you know, what I really would like to learn about is, you mentioned about that you're recovered, right? This from psychological torture. And one of the challenges that I find that people have is that voice, right? It's not so much the physical abuse and torture that people will say. It's always the story of, I wish that I could get this out of my head, or I wish I could not have this memory. So can you talk with us a little bit more about your recovery journey, and specifically about, you know, how did you do this recovery of psychological trauma?
Sure. You know, all sorts of thoughts were permeating my mind. Cliche though it may be, the scars that can't be seen are the deepest, you know, and unlike physical torture, psychological torture does not render visible scars, if you like, but it doesn't make them any less damaging or hurtful or debilitating. And how did I recover? That was a gradual, painful, slow process. And you know, often I would regress. I tried my best to progress on this recovery journey, but there were pitfalls, and I initially refused to take any psychiatric drugs and psychotropic medication. I think I was afraid. I was afraid maybe that if I did, then I would concede that I do have mental illness or psychiatric disorder, and the self stigma was such that it prevented me from taking medication. And we know actually that psychiatry receives plenty of criticism, especially because there are people, and this is really apparent on social media, people who say that they've been damaged and they've been harmed by, could be benzodiazepines or antipsychotic medication, and I tend to bear the brunt of it as a psychiatrist myself, even though I identify more as a survivor than I do as a psychiatrist, because people make that association that if I'm a psychiatrist, therefore I prescribe and I administer these drugs, which have adverse effects. I don't deny it. I experienced adverse effects when I was on medication, which I didn't find beneficial. So what really contributed to my recovery was my faith. I believe I'm a practicing Muslim. And for example, in extremis, I developed suicidal ideation. I contemplated throwing myself under traffic or a bus. But what prevented me from acting upon that impulse was Islam, because we know in Islam, suicide is forbidden. So that's an example of how faith can be a protective factor. It can also contribute to resilience as well. So we pray 5 times per day, and that kind of structure really helps to protect my mental health from worsening and from deteriorating. The power of the performing arts, you know, there's something called cinema therapy, and watching films. And I usually share this information with my audiences whenever I give a talk. One film in particular, it was a Disney film, animated motion picture, Pixar, I think, Studios, Inside Out.
Yes.
And it might shatter my masculine bravado, I know, but I felt really emotional, and dare I say it, I shed a tear or two after watching that film. But it was really therapeutic, and hence the term cinema therapy has been coined to reflect how film possesses this power to heal psychological wounds. So the performing arts, kind of reenacting scenes from films, poetry, reciting poetry, reading literature, something called bibliotherapy, art therapy, the health humanities. All of this kind of contributed to my recovery, and then exercise as well. So I'm not exercising as much as I used to, unfortunately, but I hope to resume. But I used to run 10 miles, 15 kilometers every day, and that was great because there's plenty of evidence to support how effective physical activity is at not only promoting recovery, but also it helps to prevent you from developing mental health difficulties. So that was, it really was all the above, the power of prayer, the power of the performing arts, and exercise. And they were all factors that contributed to my recovery, Dr. Lind.
That's wonderful. All of this stuff is fantastic. And folks that are listening, one of the things that I know you guys hear me say often is to download this podcast. You know, we're now on Spotify. So there's between Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and Podbean. There's got to be at least, 30 million people more that have access to our information. And so what's really powerful about this podcast, guys, is like I always say, make sure that you take notes, download it, listen to it. There's so many key tips here that's being discussed.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a solace in shared experience, Dr. Lind, you know, so by being honest and open about my lived and living experiences of mental health difficulties, people can derive comfort from that. So as you rightly said, I think if you downloaded this podcast and other podcasts that kind of feature what we call experts by experience, the messages can resonate with you, and they can be both therapeutic and cathartic.
That's so true. I mean, right now, especially one of the things with isolation, that people are finding where can I go for comfort? And so we provide every Monday the PTSD and Beyond Twitter chat that happens at 8 o'clock Eastern time for an hour for every Monday. And we've been doing that now since for 2 years. And then we have the podcast and also different live streaming. And when people will go ahead and follow me on Twitch, then they get notifications of when I do pop-ins, when we have pop-in guests. There's something that you said here too. I'm taking notes. There's so many. I gotta let you know. I'm a note taker, so that way when we're finished, there's a lot of quotes that I'll share with people. So the quote cards are really helpful for folks that are like, can I just get a couple snippets that I can download on my phone, keep as a screensaver, or even in their photos. There's several different quotes here, but it's so true, is that we do find solace in shared experience, as well as comfort with folks that are experts by experience. And so it circles back to a couple of the things that you said, is that you identify yourself as a survivor first, and then working in psychiatry. So how did you move from actually going into psychiatry? I mean, how did that all happen? Because it's not like you said, hey, you know what? I think what I'm going to do is open up my own art studio, or I'm going to go ahead and have a coffee shop where we feature, stories and poetry. No, you decided I'm going to go right into psychiatry. So how did that come about?
Sure. I mean, I experienced a debilitating episode of psychological distress when I was a medical student. This was in Manchester in the UK. And I woke up one morning to discover that my hometown in Lebanon was bombed. This was during the 2006 Lebanon War, and hundreds of people were killed overnight. And I was deeply sensitized to the horrific events that were unfolding in the Middle East at the time. I mean, there were other factors that contributed to developing a debilitating episode of psychological distress. We know that the culture in medical school can be toxic. And so this toxicity was definitely kind of a factor that that precipitated this episode. And I discovered how utterly beholden we are to the power and mercy of our minds. And I was forced to interrupt my studies. But what's important, Dr. Lind, is as devastating as the symptoms of mental illness were, the stigma was more harmful. I mean, I was ostracized, stigmatized, and dehumanized by people who I thought were my closest companions at the time. And, you know, there's nothing like an episode of psychological distress to teach you who your true friends are.
Isn't that true? Yes.
And so, as I mentioned, I gradually recovered. And so when I qualified for medical school, I had to decide what specialty to specialize in.
Mm-hmm.
And I developed this kind of renewed sense of determination and resilience, and I usually say there continues to be a fire burning in my belly and thunder in my heart. And so I decided to choose specialty, to choose psychiatry as my career choice. And I was really so, as I said, really, really so determined, because I wanted to debunk those myths. I wanted to dignify people with mental health difficulties. You know, for far too long, we have been discriminated against and our human rights have been violated. And
mm-hmm.
And so I think that was what really contributed to my drive. And I was really fortunate to receive the Royal College of Psychiatrists Foundation Doctor of the Year Award, which, as you said, marked the highest level of achievement in psychiatry in the UK. And that happened not once, but twice, because I really wanted to prove a point here, you know, that we can recover, you know, and we can be the best at what we do. That's not the point I'm making. I'm not saying that people with mental health difficulties should be the best at what they do. I don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable or place anyone under any pressure. I think the most important thing, and we had this discussion before we started recording this podcast, Dr. Lind, was, I think, for you to be happy, you know,
mm-hmm.
and do whatever you have to do to achieve that state of happiness. But I mean, I know I digress. So, but kind of back to the specific question that you posed. Choosing psychiatry, I think psychiatry has achieved so much, in the sense that many people who are the receivers of psychiatric care have recovered. Unfortunately, and we have to face the facts and confront the reality, many people have been harmed by psychiatry. And unless we actually acknowledge this and call this out, then progress will never make progress. And so I wanted to contribute to this cultural revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted psychiatry to embrace the people who they provide care to. But not only that, but also to empower them and to invite them to become psychiatrists themselves. Why not? I mean, that's the whole point, right? The whole point of psychiatry is to provide care to people with mental health difficulties so that they can recover and that they can realize their potential. And so these are kind of all the factors that influenced my decision making. And it's a journey, Dr. Lind. You know, I take it one day at a time, because I have encountered resistance. You know, there are people in the psychiatric profession who don't want those who have lived the living experience of mental health difficulties to be working in psychiatry. But I've met the majority of people I've met have actually been very supportive, and they've encouraged me. So yeah, those are all the reasons why I decided to. It's a fascinating career, and the most rewarding and thrilling aspect of psychiatry is when you provide care to people with mental health difficulties, to fellow survivors. You know, I refuse to subscribe to these kind of dynamics that exist between provider and receiver. I just, for me, it's just I I don't see any, I don't see any difference between me and the person who receives my care. And I'm hoping that we can instigate this kind of paradigm shift, because I think that dynamic can be that, as I'm, that power dynamic can be detrimental. So I'm trying to create a critical mass, and I'm harnessing the power of digital technology, sharing my recovery journey and my story with fellow survivors and wounded healers like yourself throughout the world.
I love this. I absolutely, just, you guys, I'm sure that everybody listening is so just blown away. Because I'm telling you, I'm so blown away right now. I mean, there's so many things that are going through my mind right now. Everything from the paradigm shift to a movement. There's a quotation, Ahmed, on your website. And guys, Ahmed's website is ahmedhankir.com. On the about page, there's a quote here. And it says, "When I embraced my vulnerability and came out proud with my mental illness, many others also wanted to be heard. And enough of us to start a cultural revolution." And the beauty of this is that folks, oftentimes when they're starting on their journey, are so devastated and will say, "Can I be like you? Can I be like you? Will I have days where," and fill in the blank from what we hear from our fellow brothers and sisters, because you guys, we all are brothers and sisters. Absolutely. We're all human.
Definitely. Yeah.
We have many
both.
Uniquenesses. And when people will say things like, "Well, my post-traumatic stress came from military, or my post-traumatic stress came from domestic violence or for survivors of war, or it's repeated from abuse or situational with, you know, an event such as like 9/11 or, you know, there are many, many, many places around the world where, you know, bombings are happening. And so it could be situational. It could be, I mean, just name it, right? There are so many different ways, but people will ask. And in the initial stages is, you know, can I get like this? Can I be like that? And guys, through storytelling and through sharing of our stories, and believe me, it has only been 2 years since I've shared my story. And I was like you, Ahmed, I was resistant on sharing. As a matter of fact, people keep saying, "Okay, well, where's your book? All right. How come you haven't written a book yet?" And there was a young lady who, may her memory be eternal, is no longer with us. And before she passed away, I made her a promise that I would help other people with their voices to be heard, that I would help other people with their stories, whether they wanted to write their story or write a poem about their story or do, you know, a song about their story, whatever medium, artwork, painting, interviewing, and to share it. And it's through these connections where recovery is more than just a dream. It's more than an afterthought. It's more than that. It is actually a possibility of
truth. It's a reality. Dr. Lynn. And the thing is, I know, I mean, and my job as a psychiatrist, you know, I could be a doctor, for example, working in intensive care. And, you know, my job would be to, if the patient, for example, is in cardiac arrest, then I would need to revive the patient. I would need to do whatever I have to do, you know, whatever, compressions, administer drugs so that there can be a return to spontaneous circulation so that heart can start beating again. And my job as a psychiatrist is to instill hope in people who have succumbed to despair. Because when you are at the throes of a psychiatric illness, and I'm talking out of lived experience. I mean, this knowledge, I didn't get this knowledge from a psychiatric textbook. I got this from my own lived experience. And so I can identify it when someone says to me that I don't have any hope. You know, when I ask them, you know, how do you feel about the future? And they respond, they say, there is no future. You know, I can relate to that. You know, definitely, I've been there before. I know that the world can be a dark and lonely place. Believe me, I know. And so when you're in that position or in that situation, you don't feel that you'll ever recover. And yeah, so it's understandable that you can develop suicidal ideation and that you can actually act upon these thoughts and tragically die by suicide. And so my duty is to instill hope in people. Now, the challenge is to internalize that message of recovery, both cognitively and emotionally, because knowing something and feeling something, they're two very different things.
Right.
But I mean, there's a few things that crossed my mind. One of them was that, this is another quote that you might want to document or make a note of. And this is actually from a TEDx speaker in the UK in Bristol. I'll never forget what he said. He said, just because other people have it worse. So you should never say to someone, you don't be upset, don't be depressed because other people have it worse. Never ever invalidate someone suffering or struggling. Because if you were to say that, it's tantamount to saying you shouldn't be happy because other people have it better.
Right.
Which is nonsense, which is ludicrous. Now, going back to the quote that you mentioned on my website, and that was from a fellow wounded healer in Indianapolis, Dr. Adam Hill, who is truly blazing trails in his wake. He has a book, actually, an autobiographical narrative signposting his recovery journey from kind of addiction problems. And he's really, I mean, this is no exaggeration, he really is a hero of mine. He's on Twitter. He's very active on Twitter as well. And he said, yeah, by embracing our vulnerability and by being honest and open about our struggles, our mental health difficulties, you can inspire other people to be honest and open. Enough of us to start this cultural revolution. And it's gaining traction and momentum, this cultural revolution. That is, you know, the core and key messages is that it's okay not to be okay. You know, that having mental illness is nothing to be ashamed about, because people are suffering in silence, Dr. Lind. People are suffering in silence,
yes,
despite the availability, of effective treatment. Why is there a delay? Why is it, for example, somebody who has bipolar affective disorder? Why is there a 5-year delay between the onset of symptoms and receiving a diagnosis? Why? And you know, and that delay is contributing. You were depriving people of the benefits of early intervention.
Right.
But that wouldn't be the case. If somebody had angina, you know, there would seldom, if ever, be a delay from going to your doctor or going to the emergency department and getting some, some medication, GTN or whatever spray to provide you with relief of symptoms. But the same is not happening with psychological distress. We continue to suffer in silence. And that is what I'm indignant. I'm outraged by that. That shouldn't be the case. And my contention, my hypothesis, is that by sharing our stories, then we can break down the barriers to mental health care, and that people no longer have to suffer in silence, people with mental health difficulties.
I absolutely agree. And that's another reason why this podcast was started, because stories do need to get out there. People do need to hear the conviction, especially when you speak. You can tell the difference between somebody who is like saying this from a foundation and a level of heart-based authenticity, as well as determination. And we talked about it before, that it's a mission and a purpose. You've got a drive to do this, and it has a momentum and an energy that's making traction. And with that, and I've say this so many times when you guys, we have fabulous guests that come on here, and I know that there is somebody out there right now that has heard these words before, but is saying to themselves, you know what? It's the way that Ahmed said it. It resonates with me. And you know what? I'm going to go do something for myself. Or maybe somebody is listening and it's about a family member, a loved one, a spouse, a best friend, a neighbor, a colleague, somebody that you know. Maybe somebody that you know and you don't even know them well, but you recognize and say, hey, you know what? I heard this, and you've got to listen to it, because you know what? The one thing about doing this work is you never know. And you guys, we don't always get to hear the story or the feedback from someone. And I know that another podcast guest, Kate Nasser, did The Power of Feedback. We don't always know who things resonate with. We don't always know whose life is being positively affected and changed from what you guys are hearing today. But what we do know is sometimes people will reach out and say, you know what? I saw that. I heard it. And I want you to know it changed my life. It made a difference for me right then and there. And the other beauty about these podcasts is that they're forever. They don't go away. So maybe today it's like, oh, I'm hearing the words. But you know, the cool thing is about it is whoever's listening to this right now, it is these words and this podcast, everything about it is in your memory now. And it may resurface and you might say, I don't know, 2 weeks down the road, a day down the road, maybe even an hour. You're doing something and you're saying, you know what? I heard that from somewhere. Why is this coming to me now? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely. And, you know, everything you just said now, Dr. Lind, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And it's really interesting what you were saying about, you know, it's kind of embedded somewhere in your mind, conscious or your unconscious mind, and you might be in that kind of crisis situation, and you might be contemplating suicide, and for whatever reason, that kind of memory resurfaces, and that can be the difference between life or death.
Yes,
you know. And there are people listening to this podcast right now, and there are people who might listen to this in the future. And if you're in that situation, and I know it hurts, and you're afraid because of the kind of the public stigma and these kind of stereotypes that are being perpetuated by the media or in film. But if you're listening now, and you might be crying even. Or you might be at, you know, on the edge, literally and metaphorically. You know, please don't give up. Don't throw that towel in. I know it's easier said than done. Believe me, I know. And it hurts and you're suffering and you're struggling. But after hardship, there is ease. After hardship, there is ease. You know, and where you are now is where we were before. And if we can recover, I'm not here to impose my story on anyone. Far be it from me to do so, but I want to speak with you with conviction. I don't want there to be a trace of uncertainty or ambiguity in my voice or in the tone of my voice, because this is a fact. What I'm saying is a fact. You can recover. If I can recover, you can recover too. I can't emphasize that enough. And I know that you might have succumbed to despair, and that, you know, that you feel that there's no hope, but there is. Please don't give up, please, because life is for living. Life is
absolutely
for living.
I'd like to believe too. You talk about hope, so another reason why, you know, we have so many different areas for folks to, you know, to reach out, and why we do the pop-ins, right? So if somebody says something on Twitter or there's a comment or something, instead of just doing a repost, what I do is I actually do a pop-in where there have been people who said, I can't believe that you took the time to talk to me. And what I want people to understand is that we're here together. Ahmed and I are here together because it's true. We walk a journey. We walk a path. And if we can recover, then so can you. If people are out there that are number people, right? We get people that will look at statistics and data. We are a cluster. Now, we know that there are other clusters, okay? We know that there are other clusters, say, of like, you know, tried something, didn't work. We are clusters of hope. We are clusters of data that shows you proof that recovery is a reality. It's not a pipe dream. It's possible and a reality, because we represent that cluster of that reality, which brings me to the next question that I want to ask so bad. Which is, because you mentioned before, Ahmed, you mentioned before about knowing and feeling are totally two different things. Yeah. And sometimes those things get confused. So emotion is what takes over sometimes. Emotion clouds. How many times have I met with executives and they're like, oh, well, the data shows. I want the data. And I always say to them, yeah, but you know, I'm going to give you that freaking report. It doesn't matter because you're going to go with what your gut says and you're going to go with what your emotions tell you, regardless of the data point. And we all know it to be true. So let's talk about emotions. And you there's this phrase here about oscillations and emotions. Can you talk with us about, what does it mean and why is it so profound?
Oscillations and emotion. Okay. So I know that diagnostic labels have utility and they can be helpful, but I tend to avoid them because it just feels like it's a reductionistic approach to who I am, you know, and people have their kind of preconceptions and there can be negative connotations and they can have like kind of stigmatizing nuances. And I just find it's just better if I describe my experiencing, my experiences. So I say kind of oscillations and emotion, and people tend to be a bit more inquisitive. They'll say, what do you mean by oscillations and emotion? And I say, okay, well, you know, sometimes I can be up there. I can feel euphoric or elated or exuberant. And when I'm up there, this is how I think. This is how I talk. This is how I behave. And sometimes I'm down there. And, you know, I think you can all relate to feeling melancholic and you can, you know, you can have a bad day or you can drown yourselves in your sorrows like there was no tomorrow. And so by being kind of descriptive and by using kind of expressions like oscillations and emotion, then I help that. I think that helps to reduce the stigma. People tend to be less judgmental. They tend to be more inquisitive, and it yields more kind of compelling insights.
You know what's interesting about this? You talk about being more inquisitive, right? And I don't know if you recently saw this video on Twitter. This was so cute. I retweeted. It was two girls. I think they might be 9 or 10 years old. They're quite young, and yeah. They consider themselves to be twins. They dress alike. They do everything together. Mm. And when we look at kids, right, there's this level of play. And I know I did another episode on the value of playing and how I'm sitting here and I still have my cans of Play-Doh on my desk. The way of playing when we were kids, or if we had the inability to play because of, you know, maybe our home was abusive and we didn't have opportunities to do that, or maybe where we lived, it was impossible to play. As adults now, guys, we get to make these choices, right? We have there's a way that we can empower ourselves every day, and that is through decision making and making a decision based on the choices that we have. So we can, for example, we can play. And what Ahmed's talking about here is this description is that we can decide and describe our emotions. We can decide and describe our mental state. We can describe and decide on how we want to move forward with where we want to be, because it's all a way of being. And mindfulness teaches us to increase our awareness of being, as well as when we work through. And I know this is really tough, you guys, and I've done videos on this. It's not easy. Believe me, in this moment right now, I've got like the energy to say yes. It's with a hopeful, you can do this, to go through and work through challenges, because on the other side of it, guys, is freedom. On the other side of it is freedom. And don't get me wrong. I know you all have seen videos where I've struggled because you guys have said, like, oh, I love when you post that. Those are hard for me to do because I'm raw at those point. And there's people out there who are going to look at it. And to talk about the stigma, there have been folks that have asked, Ahmed, you know, what do you do when somebody imposes stigma? And what I say is, I don't accept it. I actually will say to someone, okay, let's talk about this. You have the need to project stigma. So how are you doing? What's going on in your world that you feel the need to do that? Because it's not mine to own. Because I don't have stigma. I don't accept it. It's not in my vernacular. Mm. And when somebody tries to do that, I give the suitcase back and say, no, thank you. It's not a trip I want to go on. Obviously, that's a trip that you want to take, that journey, but not me. And I don't promote that journey or to get on that airplane or bus. So What is it about stigma and sharing our stories? Because you said you've got a hypothesis, and I love that. I know we talked before about algebraic equations. Mm-hmm. I also have hypotheses and things that we'll see if they, you know, test them out. Is there a pattern we can make it a best practice? So
yeah,
how do we, through our stories, do more than reduce stigma? How can we eliminate it and eradicate it from a mindset where it's normalized? How do we do that?
I mean, this is a kind of a science. You know, there's an evidence base to reducing mental health related stigma, and there are real kind of experts in the field. And for example, Professor Sir Graham Thornycroft at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, that's Thornycroft, is based here in London. And they've kind of conducted extensive research into kind of defining, operationalizing mental health stigma, developing and validating psychometric stigma scales. And what I mean, let's start off by defining it. You know, what is stigma? And we know that maybe perhaps one of the most influential, if not the most influential individual in the field of mental health stigma would be Irving Goffman, who's president of the American Sociological Association, and defined it as a deeply discrediting attribute that reduces the bearer from a wholly unusual person to a tainted and discounted one. So it's a deeply discrediting attribute. What is the attribute? It could be your sexuality, it could be having mental illness, it could be your faith. And we know that Islamophobia is a growing problem in the West. It could be your race. We know that racism is very topical at the moment with all the kind of the civil unrest and the world and is kind of convulsing at the moment. And so we have this something called intersectionality, when you have kind of these multiple layers of stigma. So you could be, for example, a young black man who is homosexual, and you could also, for example, have mental illness. So that's the triple stigma. Unsurprisingly, outcomes in that group tend to be poor. How do we challenge stigma? There are three broad ways. If you look at the stigma literature, there are three broad ways, usually through protest. What we're doing now, we're protesting, aren't we? We're parading against the racial stigma and discrimination. And then there's also through education. We know how important education is. That, for example, we have these stereotypes and we try to, or these myths, and we try to debunk those myths. Or people who have mental illness are violent. Well, that's a myth. That's not true. That's not a fact. And so we can reduce stigma through education. But the most powerful way of reducing stigma, and we know the highest level of evidence is what we call a systematic review and a meta-analysis. When we pool the results of all of these different studies, and the most effective way of reducing mental health related stigma is when you make contact with somebody who has recovered from mental illness. Because because we have these preconceptions, and when we meet these people, we discover they have hopes and fears and vulnerabilities and dreams like everyone else. Like these people are human.
Right.
And there's an evidence base to this. This is the most effective way of reducing mental health related stigma. And so the stigma experts, they say that those who have lived experience, experts by experience, should be operating at the vanguard of any anti-stigma campaign. And so when we say that, share your story, share your recovery story, it's not just kind of anecdotal. No, there's an evidence base. Any anti-stigma program needs to be data-driven and evidence-based. Right. So this is so what we would kind of recommend you do is, if you're really interested, don't get me wrong. It's not in my place to impose my approach on anyone. It's a personal choice. You might feel I'm not ready. I'm not ready to share my story, and that's absolutely fine. What we're saying is that I found it deeply empowering, therapeutic, and cathartic, and many other people found it as well. So, but to emphasize, if you feel that you're not ready, then of course you don't have to. Don't do anything you don't feel uncomfortable with. But there is a manual produced by the stigma expert Patrick Corrigan in Chicago, and it's called the Honest, Open, and Proud Manual. And it provides you with guidance on how to share your story. What, for example, what do you share? How much of your story do you share? Who do you share it to? When do you share it? On what platform? Is it face-to-face, or is it at the workplace, or is it on social media? So that manual, the Honest, Open, and Proud manual, will provide you with guidance on how to share your recovery story, if you like.
Folks, I'll have all of this information that Ahmed's talking about in the podcast description with active links. And so don't worry about if you're taking notes and stuff like that. I'll make sure that this information, including some of the folks that Ahmed's mentioning, to take a look at on Twitter, and some of these other folks to reference. We'll go ahead and have that information posted in the podcast description. So to wrap up our interview here, you know, we talk about the wounded healer movement. I think this is a really nice segue to get into that. Can you share with folks a little bit more about the wounded healer movement and how can they be involved? Because one of the things, before people might want to consider sharing their story, how about listening to other people's stories?
Yeah.
Connecting with others and hearing other people's stories. So let's just say, hypothetically, say somebody is at the point where I'm not comfortable yet sharing my story, but where I am making my first step is to hearing about others.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
the definitely. More that you can hear others. So let's talk a little bit about the wounded healer movement and how can people become involved in that?
So, I mean, when I say the wounded healer movement, and thank you for asking, Dr. Dunn. So when I say the wounded healer movement, I guess what I mean by that is that, as I mentioned, I pioneered this innovative anti-stigma program that blends the power of storytelling and the performing arts with psychiatry. And I delivered, it's about 1 hour long in duration. Initially I was delivering it face to face. So I would go to venues and locations nationally in the UK and then globally. So I've delivered the Wounded Healer to in person to over 75,000 people in 19 countries and 5 continents worldwide. So for me, that was like, in a sense, I was kind of creating this movement. And now, this is the digital age, and I think in a way I've been dancing in the dark for a long time, because I was delivering the Wounded Healer lectures and talks and presentations at venues. But as you said, with this podcast, that's the beauty of this podcast, that it can it stays out there forever, right? And there's no limit to the number of people who can listen to it and who can benefit from the content of this podcast. And so what we're doing now is creating these clips. I have a YouTube channel now. It's Mental Health with the Wounded Healer, and I've only kind of recently started this channel. I'm hoping that because it's the digital age, we can leverage the power of digital technology and people can access that whenever they want to, wherever they are, and however many times they want to. So if you wanted to kind of contribute to this Wounded Healer movement, if you like, you can view that content. So by all means, please do subscribe to my channel. We talk about anything and everything to do with mental health. And then when you feel that you have enough knowledge, if you have enough confidence, then by all means, start your own YouTube channel or, give a talk locally. It could be wherever. It could be at your community center. It could be your church or your temple or your synagogue. It could be at your university. When I say wounded healer, usually I'm referring to healthcare providers, because healthcare providers, in a sense, are healers. But obviously, healing comes in many different forms. And you're wounded because you have your own kind of lived or living experience of psychological difficulties or problems. But you don't have to necessarily be a wounded healer. You could be, for example, a teacher who has lived a living experience. And you can speak to your pupils, or you can speak to your fellow teachers, or you could be a police officer, because we know that mental health stigma is a real problem in the criminal justice system and that kind of and that particular workforce. So you could be what we call a human healer, not necessarily a wounded healer. You could be a human healer, but I mean, I would argue that these wounds they can be humanizing, and that's my mission. My mission is to humanize psychiatry by trying to, and I've collaborated with the Royal College of Psychiatrists and their True Psychiatry campaign, because we're targeting experts by lived or living experience. We're saying, come join our profession, because we need you, because your lived or living experience is an asset, is a strength that we embrace. To conclude, please do view content that is produced by Wounded Healers. You're more than welcome to subscribe to my channel. And I think hopefully there will be a link to that. And then once you kind of once you feel more confident, and it's really important also because we're on a journey, on this recovery journey. And so my humble advice and recommendation will be for you not to share when you feel that you are unwell, because obviously our judgment can be influenced by these kind of psychological problems and these mental health difficulties. So I think it's more kind of towards the end of convalescence, or when when you've made the recovery, and that because it's a big decision to make if you should embrace your vulnerability and be honest and open and proud about your mental health difficulties, or if you feel I'd rather remain discreet about it now, and maybe in the future I will consider if it's right for me. But then, so once you feel that it's right for you and that you're ready and that you have the knowledge and that you have the confidence, then by all means, it's simple. Just get that's what I'm doing. I don't have any fancy equipment. Just use your smartphone, use your device, and take a clip, or create some content, make a recording. And you're just talking on, for example, how was it over the last 24 hours? How has your day been? Did you wake up? Were you feeling melancholic? Were you feeling vivacious or effervescent? Or just describe how you were feeling. And were there any kind of, was there any adversity that you had to overcome? These are examples of what I call contributing to the wounded healer movement, if you like.
I love this. I absolutely love it. Folks, it's just, I'm sure that everybody here that's listening is saying, you know what, this is one of the best podcast guests we've had. Again, our bar keeps going up and up and up, and it's like, holy buckets, right? Where's all this leading? And it's so true. One of the things, Emma, that you touched on is that we can ask ourselves, what was the last 24 hours like? And we can get to a place where we're comfortable with our recovery, where we're saying, I'm open and I'm proud. I'm open and I'm proud. And maybe you're not feeling that way right now today, but guys, remember that it's a process, on this journey of recovery. And when you get to that place, you'll know it and you'll feel it. And the beauty of it is there's so many people, you guys, that are out there that are supporting. And we'd like to believe that at PTSD and Beyond, our community is one of those places. It's a safe place that you can go and you can become, and get knowledge, connect with people who've been there, who feel that, who know it, and who can also say we're stronger together, that nobody is alone. And through our storytelling and our sharing, we really do provide hope, and we're all healers. Everybody is a healer. Everyone is a teacher, and together we unite and reduce things like stigma and provide and create a better world for ourselves right now, as well as our future. And that's where that phrase being a cycle breaker and a legacy builder comes in. Ahmed, if there's just a couple more things that you'd like to share before we wrap up, what's two to three more thoughts that you'd like to share with our PTSD and Beyond community?
Well, I mean, you said it yourself, you're not alone. Don't think for a moment that you're alone, because it might feel like you are isolated and that nobody cares about you. That's not true. I don't think I can say this enough, Dr. Lind, that, having mental health difficulties, psychological distress, it's nothing to be ashamed about. If anything, my lived and living experience has not only made me a better doctor, it's made me a better human being. It's shaped my worldview. I'm actually grateful for it. In a sense, I wouldn't have decided to choose psychiatry as my career, which is my dream job. And, I don't mean to say this to boast. I'm just trying to make a point. I'm the recipient of the Royal College of Psychiatrists Awards, which marked the highest level achievement of in psychiatry in the UK, not despite my lived and living experience, but because of my living and lived experience of mental health difficulties. So it's really kind of embracing that vulnerability And recovery, we've said it before, we'll say it again, recovery is a reality for the many, not for the few.
Exactly. Folks, if you want to find more about what Dr. Ahmed Hanker is doing, you can go ahead and follow him on Twitter with the @ AHMEDHANKIR. Again, I'll have this information posted in the PTSD and Beyond podcast description. You can also please subscribe to his YouTube channel. You can go ahead and search for his name on YouTube, as well as visit his website at AHMEDHANKIR.com. And he's also the author of The Wounded Healer. Go ahead and get a copy of his book. Ahmed, thank you again so much for being here. Folks, this is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond. And again, we'll see each other again next Friday with more fabulous guests again. Ahmed, thank you so much for being here today. Can't thank you enough.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.